Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to another week, or twice a month, as it were, of Cambridge Inside Out. I'm Robert Winters, and today is February 6th, 2024. I was noticing when I was looking at the recordings of the programs from last month, I kept saying it was February when it was actually January. So I hope I didn't totally confuse people. I'm sure I didn't. Anyway, it is actually February, and we've got beyond Groundhog Day, and I guess we're sort of going to get an early spring. Isn't that good news? So, anyway, got a few things to talk about here tonight. One thing I thought I might actually just begin with was just a it was sort of a it was an announcement of a significant passing, but also a moment of nostalgia for me personally. So, Professor Charles Fried, who I didn't really know personally, I met him. He passed away, recently. There was a really nice write-up in the Boston Globe. Maybe I could actually let me do a little quick shoot over there just to take a quick look at that here. Pardon me for my goofing around here. Let's see. So this is Charles Fried now. He was U.S. Solicitor General. He was on the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. He also something that maybe not so many people are aware of is that he was advising and helping in the Question 9 campaign, which was what actually led to the demise of rent control in Cambridge. And there's a reason why I'm mentioning that. Actually, I think I'll just sort of pop out of here. For a moment here. Don't mind me if I'm goofing around here with the Zoom settings. So what happened was because of his involvement in Question 9, and again, I can't remember exactly what his precise role was. When Question 9, this was in 1994, that was the ballot question that led to the abolition of rent control in Massachusetts, not just Cambridge. And there were a lot of people who were associated with like the Cambridge Tenants Union back then and some of the affiliated groups who had a real deep animosity toward him. And it wasn't just for that. I think it was also because he was Solicitor General during some period of the Reagan years. But he was not, you couldn't pin the guy down politically. You couldn't, he described himself more as a libertarian. He was not conservative per se. He did fight, argue against abortion during those Reagan years, but later on he had a completely different point of view. And in fact, he wrote about, the importance of being able to change your mind and your viewpoint. I always found him to be a very interesting gentleman. But again, the nostalgic part of this was that, so I think it was in 1995, then Governor Bill Weld appointed him to the Supreme Judicial Court. And to do that, in order to ascend to the court, you have to go through under the review. It's really one of the very few duties that the so-called Governor's Council has, is it reviews things like judicial appointments. So I just took an interest in this. So every day when they would having their hearings down at the State House, I would bicycle down to Boston, lock up my bike, and go in there and attend the hearings. And then there were a lot of familiar faces of people from the Cambridge Tenants Union who were there to kind of jeer him and to take the opposite side. I actually found him to be a very interesting guy and very, very qualified. So I would go there, and it was interesting. Now the part that's kind of funny about it is that even though I thought I was a pretty respectable guy, I had kind of long, scraggly hair. I would show up in shorts. And somehow the Capitol Police got it into their head that I was like the world's most dangerous person. And they kept this really close eye on me. There were some seriously bad guys in the audience, but they somehow thought I was the bad guy. And I remember being on multiple times asked to show my identification. And I kind of laugh about it a little bit because I was teaching at Harvard in the mathematics department at the time. And the way if you're on the faculty at Harvard, it's your card says officer. It doesn't say faculty, it said officer, right? So they asked me to show your ID. So I pulled out my Harvard ID And it says, "Officers, you with the Harvard police." I had to explain to them, "No, officer on a Harvard card does not mean you're a police officer." But it was kind of funny. Anyway, I thought, "Oh, I'm finally successfully convinced them that everything's good, and I'm a perfectly safe person to have here in the state house." But then when the vote was taken, and or actually was it had to be the tie had to be broken by the governor. So Bill Weld appears, and he was the tie-breaking vote to for the appointment of Charles Freed. And when everybody was leaving the room, people was going into the staircase, and then the police didn't want me in the staircase at the same time as the governor because they still felt I was a very suspicious character. So I had to wait until the governor had cleared away before they would allow me in the staircase. Anyway, those are just some recollections, just triggered by the passing of Charlie Freed. So, now, speaking of some more sort of nostalgia, as many people may know, I keep track of city council affairs, and I've been going up to city council meetings for really a scary amount of time, like probably 35 years. Maybe a little less so now, quite honestly. But one of the things that I do every week when there's a city council meeting is I put together these, little compact guides that show, all the agenda items. I started doing it as my own little sort of checklist for things, just to keep track of stuff with little scrawly notes and stuff. But I would, dutifully go over to the senior center and pick up this big bundle of all the city council agenda materials. And boy, they were collecting. I mean, you could have filled a room with all this stuff. So over the last few years, I've been kind of thinning them out, just keeping some of the significant stuff. So, reduce a room full of stuff to a few files, a few racks of things, a few boxes full of files and stuff. But it's interesting when you go through it, you start running into things that you remember, and you sort of people you remember, people you feel fondly about. So, and just last night, I'm just mentioning this here just because it was clearing out things. I finally caught all the way up. I'm all done now. One of the ones for strangers, I've always kept the communications from Peter Valentine. Peter, a lot of people thought Peter was crazy. Maybe Peter was crazy, but Peter was kind of good crazy, as opposed to the Bob Letramoy type of bad crazy who, like, nobody wants to listen to him. And one of the things that I just came upon was, this little one here. This was the one from this was from 2020. It's hard to imagine. It's almost 4 years ago now, where he says the reason Central Square should be renamed Starlight Square is the fact that we don't just live in a city, state, country, or planet. We live in the vastness of the cosmos. This is very, very standard Peter Valentine, quite honestly. But actually, this is the one from which they took the name Starlight Square, which they now use for that space in the parking lot that, really kind of helped us kind of survive the worst of the COVID years. Sadly, of course, Peter did not survive those years. It wasn't COVID, it was something else. But anyway, I just thought I'd mention that, and if kind of a little brief nostalgic note there is to do that. Now there's another thing, and I'm going to try and share the screen here. I just happened to catch this yesterday in just one of the mailings that I get from just as I'm a subscriber to a lot of things. So there's a place called the Norman Leventhal Map and Education Center, and they do a lot of really good work with maps and geographical information, whatever. But they also sponsor some initiatives. And there was this really, really nice piece of work that a couple of people, Joan Brunetta and Eve Loftus, have been putting together about mapping Black Cambridge, 1790 to 1820. Kind of appropriate since I guess this is the month. This is sort of to look back at such matters. But one of the things that's really quite nice is they put together a map, and hopefully this opens properly here. I'm not sure if it will. But anyway, the map is great because what you can do is you can actually zoom in and you can see it's taken a little time to respond here. But it will you can actually see sort of these important homes, where some very interesting African Americans were living, and certainly in the vicinity of my neighborhood here, my good friend Larry Ward, turns out he lives in a home which was once owned by Kamar al-Zaman Gould, right? And down the street was Violet Casimir. So we actually had some very sort of interesting people here, and I want to look into this a little bit more. But in the meantime, I just thought I would at least mention that there was this nice resource that I think it was maybe some Cambridge people did the research and putting it together. So anyway, this is the month, I suppose, we're supposed to think about these things, and this is a really nice little thing I discovered. Now, another thing that that I think is fair to say that a lot of people know that I spend time doing is I keep track of campaign finance matters, for all the political campaigns. So I'm sort of trying to navigate here quietly on the background. Yeah, here we go. So let me just do a little quick share screen here, and just to say a few things here in a moment. Here we go. All right, so what I do is, and I've probably mentioned this on the program before, is I keep track of things over a full 2 year election cycle to see, who's raising money, who's spending money, and how much over the full election cycle. And again, it's no surprise that in terms of money raised, Paul Toner was by far the top recipient of donations, over $135,000 worth, actually, followed by Mark McGovern, Burhan Azim, Denise Simmons, Kathy Zusi, and others. I just updated this afternoon, just because it is sort of an arbitrary date, but I usually do it starting in February 1st of the year following a municipal election to the following January 31st. And I just this is pretty much there may be a little dribs and drabs coming in still, but just so people have a sense of the kind of money that people do actually raise for the purpose of being elected. I also keep track of the expenditures, and I updated this about a week ago. There's not a lot of spending happening now. There is some spending that continues in through January, which is the reason why I kind of chose the February 1st date as sort of to draw the line. And you can kind of see here who is spending. Not surprisingly, Paul Toner also spent the most money. You raise the most, you spend the most, right? But there's also I keep track of the bank reports, just because those numbers should more or less coincide in terms of total money raised. Sometimes there's little discrepancies, but I like to do keep track of that. One thing I started doing this year in earnest was just take into account just how much money was being raised by sort of the big contributors. The big real estate contributors are fewer now because of they passed an ordinance that restricted how much money people with business before the city council could donate. But they purposefully left out an exemption for labor unions. Now, the problem, of course, with that is, you can be pro-labor, that's okay, but they tend to, in an incredibly biased way, they benefit incumbents. So it's basically much like an incumbency protection program. So they donated a total of $62,350 in this election cycle, of which 47,000 of which went to basically help re-elect incumbents. Some of the particular incumbents, if you actually look and see where their money was coming from, you can actually see that candidates like Mark McGovern got, almost a fifth of his money came from unions. Similarly, with Denise Simmons, Sumbul Siddiqui, even Sabrina Wheeler actually got more support at 19.3% of all of his money came from labor unions, right? And so on. I think Aisha Wilson and Vernon Walker also took in a lot of money from unions. I think the people who kind of know how to play the Democratic Party game, better tend to be the ones who also pull in a lot of union money. I think I updated this a week ago. If you wanted to get a sense about how many dollars you spend per number one vote, not that that's a perfect measure, ranked from highest to lowest. So I've updated those figures. So, I mean, you can kind of get a sense about what an average amount that money is necessary to run a successful political campaign. From some of these numbers, maybe I should sort of find the average for those who won versus the average versus those who did not win. I haven't actually put that together, but I perhaps will do that soon enough. All right. So anyway, that was just a little bit of an update. Maybe in a short while, I may speak a little bit more about some of the election-related stuff, since I think as people, I'm a bit of an elections nerd. Of course, some people think I'm some sort of oracle. They think I have all the answers, which is not true. I actually find myself, as I look at trying to do more and more analysis of ballots and things, I often find myself just mystified by the unpredictability of some aspects of the way people actually vote. Though I think I've come to a few conclusions, but again, maybe we'll come to that in a short while. So, another thing I wanted to talk about now, and maybe what I'll also do a little bit of share screening in order to highlight this a little bit here. So let me just bounce back briefly here. All right. So at the most, well, we had a round two roundtable city council meetings yesterday. One was just on sort of a citizen survey, and the other one just was a roundtable with both the school committee and the city council, where apparently the limitation of tax revenue is starting to become a factor at long last. We don't have infinitely deep pockets, and apparently prioritization is starting to become a word again around here. But one of the things that was perhaps the single most significant item on the agenda at the most recent regular meeting of the City Council on January 29th was this foreign policy matter having to do with Israel and Gaza. And again, for those who are not aware, it was, I believe, on November 20th, there had been a resolution put forth with the City Council to take a stand calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, right? With a lot of loaded statements, accusations and whatnot, in a kind of a curious vote, that was most of the city council voted present, so that the matter did not prevail, but people didn't want to really get on the record saying yay or nay, so that kind of infuriated some people. It didn't infuriate me. I completely understood it. I actually would have done the same, I think, if I was in that position. But anyway, the protesters kept coming around, and they certainly did come around quite recently. And I'll speak to a little bit more to this in a second here. But they showed up and they busted up the inaugural meeting on January 1st. They came back at another meeting and again just tried to sort of shout things down. And then the city council had to kind of retreat into their offices and reconvene the meeting in Zoom. And honestly, I didn't know how this was going to get resolved, but I guess the protesters said, well, we're going to keep coming back until you pass a resolution. Condemning the actions in Gaza, and I think they wanted it to be called genocide. I don't so sure that that's what came out of this whole process, but it really got kind of ugly. In fact, I'll just sort of click on here. In the weekend before that meeting, I was walking down Inman Street going to meet some people, and came upon these posters here. I'll show it here. They had done posters like this actually at the inaugural meeting, making direct accusations of naming city councilors and saying you're guilty of genocide and whatever. This is just one particular one there, because now that Denise Simmons is the mayor, I think they really wanted to highlight Denise Simmons in this one and basically accuse her of genocide, which is of course ridiculous. But it was interesting with that coming up here, this notion about the city council focusing on these sort of international matters. Somebody on some sort of social media just happened to point out that, this is nothing new for the Cambridge City Council. This is actually a clipping from the Boston Herald in 1935, which says Cambridge Ca City Council rebukes Germany. They were condemning Nazi Germany's persecution of Catholics and Jews. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So actually coming out of the it's been unanimous vote of the Cambridge City Council in 1935. So and again, so for those who think this is sort of a new phenomenon of the Cambridge City Council getting, opining on international affairs, not so. I mean, that's like almost like 90 years ago. So anyway, it was, I have to say though, it was very disturbing because Denise Simmons, I actually view her as a personal friend. So when people start putting things like this up on signposts on Inman Street or these big nasty looking ones here, I'd love to know who was printing these out with these nice colored printers, a large format, because I suspect somebody's doing it at work. I tore them down. I admit it. I tore down posters. Because it's one thing if you're people are making just general state political statements, they have every right to do so. But this is like getting personal. These are personal friends of mine, so I'm not feeling particularly tolerant of it. Anyway, they did. The matter came to before the city council in the form of a resolution on the what was it on the 29th? And it was kind of an interesting back and forth because the original resolution had a few loaded statements in there, making accusations, and then others were trying to come up with some sort of more middle road statement that was really more like we think killing people's bad and yada yada yada, right? And it was an interesting back and forth amongst the city councilors. Most particularly, I would say with Patty Nolan, who I think comported herself quite well, but Sumbul Siddiqui, maybe not so much. For example, and this was a little bit of a replay of what happened with the Somerville City Council and some other cities in America as well, where somehow the notion about identifying Hamas as being engaged in terrorist activity was somehow viewed as controversial. Really. The former mayor apparently couldn't bring herself, and two other city councilors too, couldn't bring herself to vote for that way, without basically sort of doing a little dose of whataboutism, instead of saying like, well, don't you know the other guys, they're all terrorists as well, and why should we single out Hamas? And I thought, that doesn't really work for me. Anyway, in the end, they kind of hammered something out, which I thought was relatively, benign. But in the end, the group that wanted this resolution here, they just wanted to be able to say that we made the city council declare vote in favor of a negotiated ceasefire. So any of the particulars were just forgotten on them. They just said, oh, they went into a celebratory dance. Saying, look how we actually brought them to our knees. It was interesting how a few days ago, last week when I was up to teach my Harvard class, there was actually posters on Harvard Yard. It said ceasefire, Cambridge declared ceasefire, but then actually put in some of the actual language, which was actually this was more of a pro-Israel group that was actually interpreting things a little bit differently. So anyway, I guess everybody can interpret stuff the way they want. Personally, I'm still not going to be too forgiving of anybody who showed up 2 days after a massacre at the on the front of City Hall, including half the brass of the Cambridge Residents Alliance celebrating Hamas as somehow a glorious act of resistance. I'm never going to like you people. Thank you very much. So anyway, that was kind of a big deal. There was one other item, and I'll take a little bit of a break here, but there was another item which was introduced at the January 22nd meeting. And then, I guess it was subject to the charter, right? And it came back on the 29th, was yet another city council order calling for the city to purchase another building in Central Square. Some of you may know that the city did purchase the what we still sometimes call the Citizens Bank building, even though Citizens Bank is now moved across the street. And maybe one day the library will move into there. I think that would be a good use. Maybe some city offices. But the other building on right, directly across Temple Street, which is the old Gaslight building, there was a developer from the Chevron Group who wanted to redevelop it as a hotel, but apparently ran into some roadblocks, financial roadblocks or whatever, and apparently was putting the property on the market. And so there's a city council order saying, Mr. City Manager, we should buy that building too. And I keep saying to myself, all right, I'm perfectly happy to acknowledge space needs for, more staff and whatever. But there does come a point where the role of government shouldn't really be to simply be gobbling up every available space in and around Central Square in order to grow and grow and grow your administration and your staff and whatever. So I don't know where this process of demanding purchasing of land and taking everything by eminent domain, where does it goes? But I'm a little leery about the city's intent, if the city's even going to do this. And by the way, they did have some kind of meeting recently where, for the first time in a while, city management was actually saying that we have to start prioritizing because we do not have infinite amounts of money, and we do have to start taking into account the fact that commercial property values may be taking a hit, sort of post-COVID phenomena. Residential values are rising faster than you can keep track of, it seems. And you may very well start seeing a real shift in the residential tax rate. I don't know if you'll see it this year. I think you probably will. And at some point, you may actually start seeing, and people, and by the way, the city is still investing large amounts of money into what they like to call affordable housing, but I kind of find that to be a bit of an oxymoron when you're dropping, somewhere way north of a $500,000 and sometimes closer to $1 million per unit. And also giving up tax base every time you do it for every single unit you build of the so-called affordable housing. Affordable housing actually makes housing a little less affordable for everybody else, in truth. Anyway, I do hope that they sort of come to grapple with some of these issues in this coming year. But anyway, more about that in a second. So I'm going to take a little bit of an artificial break here and resume seconds later. So, but we'll see you in a minute on Cambridge Inside Out.